This morning I want to take us through our annual Esther sermon, our Thanksgiving sermon. Those of you who know, I preach on certain things throughout the year, and every year when November rolls around, I like to take you through the story of the Jewish Thanksgiving. Awesome story. Many of you have probably heard me do this 15 or 20 times, but I still haven't gotten it right yet or got it full. There's so much here. So turn with me, if you would, to the book of Esther. Little background. In the book of Genesis, chapter 25, you don't have to turn there, but you can make a note and go look at this. We read of this man named Isaac, who's the son of Abraham, and his wife, Rebecca, is barren, so they pray unto the Lord that they might have children, and God blesses them. And then Rebecca notices that she's having a very unusual pregnancy because there seems to be a lot of strife going on inside her womb. And so she asks the Lord about that, and the Lord, I don't know if he speaks to her directly or in a dream or whatever, but it's revealed to her specifically that there's two types of people in her womb. There's two nations. And he says that one of them will overcome the other. One will be stronger than the other. And the elder shall serve the younger. The one who shall overcome is the younger one. Those two twins grew up to be Jacob and Esau. Jacob was the younger. He became the father of Israel. And by this, God is representing the fact that there are certain people in this world represented by Jacob, represented by Israel, whom God loves. Esau, on the other hand, represents natural man, not the spiritual man, not the man of the kingdom of God, but the men of this world. And it may pain us to say this, and quite frankly, it may shock some people to know that God is at war with these people. God doesn't just, he's not just indifferent to them. He is opposed to natural man. In the 17th chapter of the book of Exodus, we get introduced to a group of people called the Amaleks, or the Amalekites. I guess we can call them the Amalekites. Amalek was a grandson of Esau. And this is the nation that attacked Israel as they were walking through the land of Sinai. They attacked the rearward parts. And you remember the story how that Moses had to hold his rod up during the day. And as long as he held his rod up, the armies of Israel would be victorious over the Amalekites. But he would get tired, and he'd lower his staff. And the moment that happened, then the Amalekites would win. And so it says that Joshua and another man stood there and actually steadied his arm to help them have the victory. And God there pronounced a great judgment against the Amalekites. And he said that I am at war with them forever. We fast forward to the time of the king Saul, 500 years later. It's about 1000 BC now. Saul is the king of Israel. He's going out to war. God says, here's the Amalekites. I want you to go destroy them. Destroy them utterly. Consume them. You might say, God, that sounds really mean. That sounds really not fair. I thought God was a God of love. Yes, he is a God of love for his people. But he's also fierce in his wrath against sin. And God, the sovereign God, has chosen his people. Remember, Jacob and Esau. Not because they did anything at all, but because of God's election. God's love. And that's why we stand before him, because of his love for us. Anyway, you remember the story. Saul thought he would do one better. He didn't actually kill all the Amalekites. He kept the king there, Agag, kept them alive. And Samuel came and confronted the king and ultimately killed him himself. And Saul lost his kingship. So there's some spiritual lessons here for us. We all carry around a little bit of Jacob, and we all carry a little bit of Esau in us, right? Right? We've got a little bit of spiritual man, and we got a little bit of natural man. God says, don't make friends with your natural man. You got to be merciless. You got to seek after the things of God. None of us can do that very well, but that's the lesson that's being taught. The reason I went through all of that is because this forms a very important background to the story of Esther, because we're going to be introduced to a man named Mordecai, who is a son of Jacob. And we're going to be introduced to a man named Haman. If we were in a synagogue right now, everybody would hiss. You can do that if you want. Haman's a wicked man. He's an Agagite. He is actually a descendant of this king Agag. The story of Esther is a very interesting story for another reason. Not only does it tie into this eternal struggle between Satan's kingdom, as it were, kingdom of this world, and God's kingdom and God's triumphant ultimate redemption of it and the furtherance of His kingdom. One of the things that people sometimes say when they're looking at the Bible is they say, you know, it's just hard to believe all these miracles that took place. You know, the Bible's full of miracles and signs and wonders and things. But you know, this is a point that Brother David made to me one time, Brother David Piles, and he said, you know, really, if you were an Old Testament Jew, the chances are that you would probably never actually see a miracle in your life. Okay? You know, a sign. I'm not talking about a providence of God. I'm talking about one of those really big miracles that we keep thinking about. If you think about it, there are only four people in the Scriptures who really did a lot of miracles. Only four. Only four people. 90% or more of all of the miracles, all the signs, all the wonders in the Bible were done by just four men. One of them was Moses, right? Right? Everybody remember Moses? There were a lot of miracles in the time of Moses. Oh, by the way, he said there'll be a man like me who'll be raised up. Obviously, the fourth one is Jesus Christ. He's the one who did many signs and wonders. Even Josephus, an unbeliever, acknowledges that. But the other men were Elijah and then Elisha, who asked for a double portion of Elijah. So really, Elijah gets credit for the things of Elisha. So it's kind of interesting. And by the way, I've been thinking about the fact that on the Mount of Transfiguration, if you were going to try to convince a Jew that Jesus Christ is the Lord, what better way to do it than have him see both Moses and Elijah, the greatest lawgiver and the greatest prophet, both testifying concerning the things of Jesus Christ. And that's exactly what we see on the Mount of Transfiguration. So that's kind of cool also. The reason I say that is this, is that in the book of Esther, there are no miracles. I mean, there's providence, but there aren't any overt signs and wonders. There's not fire coming down from the skies. There's not the Red Sea opening up. And yet it's just as great a deliverance. The reason I like the book of Esther so much is that this is exactly the way God works in our lives too. We sometimes say, God, send a miracle. What we really ought to be saying is, God, send providence. Send your provision for me. Because as we go through this story, you're going to see how God brings together these wonderful things, these seemingly unrelated things, but He brings them all together and delivers God's people. And He still does that for us today, if we would just have our eyes open. So this is a wonderful story. Let's get started. I'm going to try to go through the entire book. I'll try not to take a lot of time. I know we're kind of late, but you should be familiar with the story. It says that, now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, and then to clarify, he says, this is Ahasuerus which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia over 127 and 20 provinces. This man is sometimes referred to as Ahasuerus the II. He's also referred to as Xerxes. Okay, remember the movie 300? It came out a few years ago. Wasn't completely historically accurate, but it was the general idea. In 480 or so, Xerxes the Great, or Xerxes the First, the great man, the great king, brought a huge army together to try to invade the Greek Empire. And he ultimately failed. And I'll give you a little bit of background on that. It's important to understanding this story. But we already know, if you read the book of Daniel, chapter 11, you already know that this man is going to stir up the whole world against the Greek world. In the chapter, Daniel chapter 11, you want to jot this down. I want you to go read the first two verses. That's all you got to read. It says in Daniel, it says, in the first year of Darius the Mede, who was a co-regent with Cyrus the Persian, God said to Daniel, he says, there shall yet be three more kings stand up in Persia, and the fourth shall be greater than they all, and he shall, in my paraphrase, shall stir up all of the world against Greece. And then he says, then there shall be another man who stands up, which is Alexander the Great, and he's going to go after it because of the great invasion that Xerxes is about to do. Alexander the Great, 150 years later, is going to rise up. All of this is prophetically told of God. So we see that God's hand is in this, that this man, Ahasuerus, is pulled together. He's a young king. History tells us that he began reigning around 486 at the death of his father. He was solicitous of expanding his empire. To that point, he had had the name King of Babylon among his titles. He actually wanted to go a little bit further. He said, I want to be called King of the world. And that's another reason why he was motivated to go and conquer Greece. He wasn't necessarily a bad guy, but he was a clueless guy. He was kind of like Jehoshaphat. He was kind of naive. He was very trusting. He would listen to bad advice and take it. Nevertheless, God blessed him, and he opened his eyes, as he did with Nebuchadnezzar and others. There was this giant, I was reading about Xerxes because I found it fascinating. There was a giant statue, some gold statue or something there that was in Babylon, and all of the Persian kings, for the sake of everybody getting along, would go in and touch that on a certain day. He had it melted down. And so the Babylonians weren't real happy with him. He always had to deal with insurrections. That's one of the reasons why the Greek Empire, his invasion didn't work. It's not that he was just soundly defeated. He did lose some battles, but God providentially caused an uprising in Babylon, so he withdrew from the Greek Empire, and the armies that he left did in fact fail. That's important, because we're going to see that here in a minute. The first chapter of the book of Esther tells us about this time early in his reign where there's this six-month feast in Susa, the palace. That's where the head of the Persian Empire was. His father had built that city. He expanded it. And now he's throwing a six-month feast with representatives from all of his empire. And I've supposed to you before, I've speculated, and I think that it tells us the truth, that he was planning his invasion of Greece during this. He was pulling together money. He was pulling together commitments. He was doing all of this together, showing the splendor of his kingdom and his glory. It says Herodotus is the historian who tells us that he may have had as many as a million men go and try to invade Greece, and I believe it, as extensive as his empire was. And of course, all of the Jewish people are under his control. They're members of this society, this Persian king, and so on. So it says that in the third year of his reign, which would work out perfectly, because that would be about 582. It would be just before the battles. So this works out exactly with what secular history tells us. Of course, it's in the Bible. We don't need secular history to confirm that for us, but it is the truth. In the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty many days, even 104 score days, 180 days, 6 months. And when the days were expired, the king made a feast unto all the people that were present in Shushan the palace, both unto great and small, 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. So it was sort of like an Oktoberfest, but instead of serving beer, they served wine. Where were white and green and blue hangings. It was really an elaborate affair, and so on. But it says also that the drinking was according to the law, none did compel. For so the king had appointed to all the officers of his house that man should do according to every man's pleasure. No doubt the king partook quite a bit, and that clouded his judgment, as we're about to see. Vashti was the name of his queen, his chief wife. She was obviously a very beautiful and forbidding figure. There was a lot of palace intrigue going on, so we may see some of that going on in the background. But anyway, it says, on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded these seven chamberlains, these were his closest advisors, that served in the presence of Ahasuerus the king, to bring Vashti the queen before the king with the crown royal, to show the people and the princes her beauty, for she was fair to look on. He wanted to kind of show off his trophy wife. Okay? He wanted to bring her in front of all these guys and show her off. Now, the queen refused this command, and it has been speculated that was an appropriate thing to do, because, you know, the king was obviously tipsy. This was not a decorous kind of thing. It was not for his own honor that he was doing this, and it was not for her honor either. So she refused. The king might have laughed it off as jovial as he was, but some of these same chamberlains who might have used this as an opportunity to get rid of her said, this is a calamity. This is the worst thing that has ever happened, because your wife has publicly disobeyed you and refused to come in. Every woman in the Persian Empire is now going to get uppity. That's what they said. It's going to be calamity. Women will no longer pay attention to their husbands. Cats and dogs are going to live together. It's going to be awful. Okay? Of course, none of that would be true, but that's what happened. So if it pleased the king, let there go a royal commandment from him, and let it be written among the law of the Persians and the Medes, that it be not altered, that Vashti come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal estate to another that is better than she. And so this was published, and it says, and when the king's decree, which he shall make published throughout all his empire, all the wives shall give to their husbands honor, both to great and small. And the saying pleased the king and the princes. It stroked his ego, and at that moment he thought it was a good idea. And the king did according to the word of Memucan, and for he sent letters unto all the king's provinces, unto every province according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language, that every man should bear rule in his house, and that it should be published according to the language of every people. Aren't you glad we live in a free society? I mean, I agree that men and women ought to comport themselves with the word of God and with each other. We ought to submit to each other. I don't have any problem with that, but I don't need somebody giving me a lecture on that. I don't need the king telling me how I need to treat my wife or my husband. I've got one king who will do that. Anyway, in chapter 2, it says, after these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. Some have speculated, and the more I study this, the more I realize that we fast-forwarded a few years now, and King has returned from his disastrous invasion. He's still in charge of 127 provinces. He just didn't get to expand it into Greece. And he's kind of sad, and he remembers Vashti, and he says, oh yeah, can't go see her because I decreed that we would be divorced. And remember, under the laws of the Medes and Persians, even the king is bound by that. They believe that when a king would actually put his seal on a paper, that was ordained of the gods, plural gods, and he himself was not above that law. So he's out of luck as far as ever seeing Vashti again. So some of his servants, his chamberlains, his advisors say, well, I'll tell you what, let's get you another queen, one who's better than that. And so they started going out through all the provinces looking for the most beautiful, the most hot women that they could find that were eligible, and brought them into the palace and put them through a whole year of training, a beauty regime, as it were. And then the king could try them out, so to speak. I'm sorry, I'm trying to be delicate, but this is how Eastern tyrants operated. And that he could find him a king. And the rest of them would join his harem. So here we find in verse 5, it says, now in Shushan the palace, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jer, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity which had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. His great-grandfather was a man named Kish, a Benjaminite. And according to this, this man's great-grandfather had been carried away during the second invasion by the Babylonians. If we go back and kind of remember, it was around 605, 606 when Nebuchadnezzar first invaded Babylon. That year's a little sketchy, but it's around 605, 606. But he didn't destroy it. He just simply set up one of the men there, a man named Jehoiakim, to be the governor. He did carry away a lot of the vessels and things out of the temple. He also carried away a lot of the young nobles, among which were, remember, Daniel, and then their Babylonian names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They were among the young men, and they were brought back to Babylon to learn the ways of the Chaldeans. But because of the uprising that had taken place there, Nebuchadnezzar had to come back a second time, about 597. And this is when Jehoiakim was the king, and he had rebelled against God. Jeremiah, God spoke to Jeremiah the prophet and said, you submit to Nebuchadnezzar. He is a man that you are to do that. But the Jews would not. They kept rebelling against God, and they kept rebelling against the Babylonians. Jehoiakim is interesting, and we're going to study this in Bible study. We're also going to study this in our Christmas thing in a minute. Remember, there's a curse that is laid against Jehoiakim. I believe this is in Jeremiah 28. I can find that for you. But because of his rebellion, God says, no man who is a descendant of Jehoiakim will ever sit on the throne of his father David. Okay, Jehoiakim was a son of David. He was a ruler. He was a king in Judah. God said, no son of Jehoiakim will ever, ever, ever be king. Now that's significant for one reason. If you read the first chapter of the book of Matthew, we see that Joseph, the husband of Mary, was the son of Jehoiakim. Okay? Now, I know I've shared this with you before, but that's very significant that Jesus Christ cannot be the son of Joseph. Because if he was, he would be disqualified from being the king. So it's important to know that this happened. So Mordecai here is the great-grandson of this man named Kish, who had been carried over in the time of Jeconiah. And he had a young a cousin, a niece maybe, his uncle's daughter, named Hadassah, that is Esther, which means myrtle, and she was very beautiful. It says she had neither father nor mother, and the maid was fair and beautiful, whom Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took for his own daughter. And so he's raising his young cousin. I don't know how old Mordecai is. He's probably in his 40s. He's an official in the court. He's a moderate level official. He's working on behalf of the Persian Empire. And he has this young daughter who's probably 20, 18, something like that. She's a young lady. She's an eligible maiden. And she is pulled into this this contest. She gets invited. She gets an official summons. And so she, of course, reports. One of the things that Mordecai told her not to do was to reveal that she was a Jew. That's an interesting thing. There's no real danger at this point why they couldn't be. There were Jews. You know, he was a fourth generation Jew. His family had served well among the Persians. Daniel was a Jew. Clearly, he was beloved. So there's no real danger. Nevertheless, God providentially puts it upon Mordecai's heart to say, don't reveal your people. Don't let them know that you are a Jew. Esther had not shown her people nor her kindred, for Mordecai had charged her that she should not show it. And Mordecai walked every day before the court of the women's house just to know how Esther was doing. Now, it came to pass that each time that when a woman was ready, she would go in for the evening with the king. And again, we all understand what that means. And then in the morning, he would ask her what would she like, and he would give her gifts. You know, maybe she would get lands. Maybe she would get revenues from certain cities. Maybe there were debts that her family owed that would be forgiven. Maybe she wanted horses. I don't know, you know. But regardless, he would always glad to give her those things and then send her to his house. And then when he was ready for her, he would call her back. When it came time for Esther to go in, obviously God was providentially working with this. And they asked her what she would like, and she never asked for anything. She never asked for a thing. She said, I'm perfectly content with everything that's been given to me. And you young ladies, and you young men also realize how alluring that actually is, to have a young lady who really is quite satisfied and content with all that you have. Our society today is teaching people to want stuff, to demand stuff, to get stuff. But quite frankly, honestly, if you don't do that, it's very, very, very alluring. It's very remarkable. Especially in a material society, and this one was the same way. And so she found great favor, and again, God was working behind the scenes. But it says in verse 16, so Esther was taken into King Ahasuerus, into his house royal in the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. 7th year of his reign. We started off in what? In the 3rd year of his reign? Okay, so now we're in his 7th year. We're late, you know, 488, 487, something like that. And the king loved Esther above all women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the other virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And then they had this great feast and so on. And verse 20 says, Esther had not yet showed her kindred nor her people as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther did the commandment of Mordecai, like as when she was brought up with him. Then we find out something very important, very key to this whole story. In verse 21, and you guys are familiar with this, that there's a plot against the king's life. This is after she's been made the queen. And Mordecai discovers that there are two chamberlains who want to assassinate the king. A lot of this goes on. If you go study this period of time, people are getting poisoned, people are getting killed all the time. It was a very rough and savage country. I don't know why these guys were upset with the king. I don't have any idea. I don't really care. But I do know that there was a valid assassination attempt, and these were two of the king's chamberlains, so they had special access to the king where they would have him alone and they could have hacked him to pieces and made their escape. It says, those who kept the door were wroth and sought to lay hand on the king Ahasuerus. And the thing was known to Mordecai, who told it unto Esther the queen, and Esther certified the king thereof in Mordecai's name. So she said that based on information supplied to me by Mordecai, there is a plot against your life based on these two people, and she signed it. And it was investigated, and the plot was in fact discovered, and these two men were killed. And it was made in a chronicle of the king. Now, at this point, the king did not do anything for Mordecai. He didn't recognize him or anything else, but that's okay. It's a lot of times you'll do great things, you'll do wonderful things for somebody, and you may not receive any accolades for it. You may not receive any acknowledgement. Sometimes we're like that. But if you'll just let God do the honoring, if you'll do what God tells you to do, and do the right thing, and just let it go, you might just be surprised what God might actually do. Okay? We got to be willing to do whatever He tells us to do. Okay? Let's just do it as best we can figure it out, and then let God bring forth His providence, because He has promised to bless us when we're obedient to Him. Now, in chapter 3, and I will be quick, because this isn't really going to take that much longer to go through that. I wanted to give that level of detail to the story because it's important to have that background. We're now introduced to this man named Haman. After these things, did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. The Agagite. So now we all know who that is, right? We know who Agag was. Agag was the king that was hacked to pieces by Samuel. He was the king of the Amalekites. These are the sworn enemies of the Jews. These are the people whom God says, I'm at war with forever. This man is evil, he's wicked, he's wrong, he's bad. He's a son of Esau. He's a son of Amalek. He's a wicked man. And he lives up to his reputation and his pedigree. Anyway, he is advanced and set above all the princes that were with him. He becomes the vizier, he becomes the guy's right hand, his number one confidant. And so all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him, but Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. It was common in those days for the king, for everybody to bow down, prostrate yourself before him. This man Haman, who obviously wants to be king, takes advantage of his boss, gets the royal signet, gets to do basically what he wants, and he commands everybody to show him the same honor. Mordecai refuses. Now, Mordecai refuses perhaps for a couple of reasons. One is you don't worship men, you only worship God. It's one thing if it was just a simple sign of respect. I'm sure that Mordecai would have been willing to do that, even if he personally did not like Haman. But obviously, there's more at it. There's more going on here. God may have put it upon his heart. You know? I mean, this is how God does it. God sometimes emboldens his people. Let's not just get along, okay? Let's stand up. Let's see what's going to happen. Regardless, Mordecai refuses. And it becomes real apparent when Haman walks into a room and there's all these courtiers, there's all these noblemen, there's all these workers, and everybody bows down on the ground, and there's Mordecai just standing there. Hey, you know, how you doing? All right, it's real evident. And there are certain people who ask Mordecai, why aren't you bowing to Haman? And Haman says, Mordecai says, because I'm a Jew. Okay? And so these guys, if you guys ever get involved with office politics, you know how it was like, or when it's like sometimes when there's politics. Well, these guys are doing the same thing. They're trying to stir up trouble. Hey, Haman, Mordecai won't bow. Watch. Next time you walk in a room, you know, they actually call it out to his attention, and he notices that, and this man is enraged. And I don't know to what extent this man already is angry with the Jews. He's obviously a son of Satan. He's obviously a wicked man. But he decides, not only is he going to wipe out Mordecai, but God leads him in such a way. Yes, I'm saying that true. God hardens the heart so that he wants to destroy all of the Jews and all of the nation. Okay? That's what he's on. It may seem strange that this kind of genocide would take place, that they would allow that, because Haman proposes to the king, there's a people among you, he doesn't say who they are, who do not observe our customs, they don't pay attention to our rules, they're troublemakers. If somebody invades, they'll probably go over to the other side. You need to let me just wipe them out. And I know that that's going to be a lot of tax revenue that you're going to lose, so I will guarantee you'll get 10,000 talents of silver in your treasuries as a result. And the king says, that's fine, here's my ring. You know, go take care of it. Again, not the best way to administer an empire, but that's what happens. So he takes these dice or these lots called pure, and he rolls them, and God once again intervenes because it's the first day of the month. This is in the 12th year of his reign, by the way. So it's been about 5 years since these things have happened. We're about 475 now. And Haman says and treats his own gods, when would be the best time to kill all the Jews? And he rolls these dice, he throws these lots, and the date that these show up are the 12th month on the 13th day. If we used our calendar, which they didn't, but it's like in January, he rolls the dice and it says December 13th, you know, 11 months out, we're going to do this. That's going to be the most opportune time to do that. And so then he pronounces this writing, which is signed by the king's signet, that says that on the 13th day of the 12th month of this year, it's open season on Jews. Okay? You are hereby allowed and permitted to kill every Jew you can find. Okay? You get to kill them. You get to kill their wives. You get to kill their old people. You get to take all their stuff. And obviously Haman was hoping to get a big cut of that and pay back the debt that he owed the king. Now, that's a pretty bad thing. Remember what I told you about the Medes and the Persians? That once you have a writing that is signed by the king, it cannot be revoked. It cannot. And so this is a very serious thing. This isn't a small thing. This is a hard problem. This is not an easy problem. This is a very difficult problem. So much so that all of the Jews, beginning with Mordecai and the others, when they read this writing, which is published throughout all the land, there's no Jews in the world that are not subject to this extermination. And they are all terrified and crying out to God and feasting and fasting and praying that God would save them. Now, you might say, Randy, that seems ludicrous. I mean, there had to be a couple of million Jews or more. Maybe 3 million. You know, how could you just wipe out that many people? Well, do you remember 100 years ago, the Turks killed that many Christians at the first of World War I, the Armenian genocide. The Turks, even at the dying stages of the Ottoman Empire, I mean, it was soon to be gone, but with this last gasp, they still wiped out 2.5 million Armenian Christians. They just hacked them to pieces over a very short period of time. They killed all of this ethnic group in Turkey. Okay? That was 100 years ago. This is 2,500 years ago. So, you know, Hitler was emboldened by that. He said, well, the world seemed to get away with me, with the Turks. They never really complained about the fact that they wiped out a couple of million Turks. I'm going to get rid of 6 million Jews. And that's what he did during World War II. So you see the wickedness of man, that's really what we're up against. This is how awful this really is. And there's no way to stop it unless God intervenes. And that's the cool thing. That's the best part of this story. Because we look at problems. I look at this problem right now. If you had never heard this story before, and you're like, okay, how do we get out of this, right? But how many times in our life are we faced with that same kind of perplexing nature? We see something that there is no way this can be solved, you know, and it's easy to get depressed. But what you need to do is go to your knees and pray to God. Because God is the solver of problems. God knows how to solve every problem you have. And if he's not solving it right now, it's because his solution is actually better than yours. And he will fix it. Okay? He knows how to fix. He knows how to save. I mean, he is called our Savior for a reason. Because he will save us with a mighty arm. Okay? And this is what he does to this. And it is so beautiful. It is so cool how he does that. And I will fast forward. I know I'm watching the time, so you don't have to. Mordecai approaches and has a conversation through an intermediary with his daughter, Esther, the queen. And she doesn't know about it. She's living in isolation. She doesn't even know this has happened. She hasn't seen the king for 30 days. But here's this. Mordecai sends the word and sends a piece of the writing to Esther and says to her, basically, you need to go in and talk to the king. Mordecai commanded to answer Esther. Okay, here's what it says. Also he, that is, this is verse 8 in chapter 4. He gave her the copy of the writing of the decree that was given at Shushan to destroy them, to show it unto Esther. So he gave it to the chamberlain. He obviously wasn't allowed to talk to her directly, but there was an intermediary who was willing to come and go between them. So he said, give this to Esther and show it to her and declare it unto her and go charge her that she should go in unto the king to make supplication unto him and to make request before him for her people. You tell Esther that she's got to go ask the king to stop this, to ask for supplication. And she replies and says, I haven't seen the king for 30 days. I can't just walk in to his bedroom. I mean, I can't just go in and see him in his throne room. It says, all the king's servants do know that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come into the king and into his inner court, who is not called, there is one point of his to put him to death, except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter that he may live. And I have not been called or come into the king for these 30 days. It says, I'm no different. There's a standing rule that if you go in and talk to the king unannounced, Unless He holds out His mercy, you're a dead man. You're a dead man when you walk in that door. The only thing that can save you is if the king leans forward his scepter. And he might not. If the king just sits there, they grab you and kill you. So she says, I'm helpless. I can't do anything. Ever feel that way? Sometimes, like, you know, you got to do something hard, and you're like, I can't do this. Well, listen to what Mordecai said. Then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place, but thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? He basically says, look, God's going to save us. There's no way that God's going to allow His people to be wiped off. There's too many messianic promises. Daniel, you know, he says, I read Daniel. Okay, we survive as a nation. All right, you know, enlargement will come. But you will not be spared. You will not survive this. But he says, how do you know that this isn't the very reason that God made you queen to begin with? And that's the thing we need to think about. Sometimes we wonder what's going on in our lives. We'd like to have some direction. We'd like to know. Sometimes God just puts us someplace because He's going to use us when the time is right. And if we're faithful to Him, maybe we can actually be of value to Him. And so she agrees with this. She recognizes that. She says, I want you to go fast for 3 days, and I'll do the same. And then I'll go in and see the king, and if I perish, I perish. That's what faith is. Faith is not knowing the outcome. Faith is not necessarily knowing how it's going to turn out, but knowing it's going to be okay. And that's what God wants us to do. He wants us to walk by faith. And that's what these people did. So they did, they prayed, they fasted, and I know I'm getting close on time, but I promise you I can wrap this up. So after 3 days, she put on her best, she washed and put on her apparel and went to see the king. He held out the scepter to her. You know, you ever worry about something for 3 or 4 days and then everything's fine? Okay, that happened. And he says, what can I do for you? And you remember, she's never asked the king for anything. Ever. As far as we can tell, she's, you know, that's just it. So here she's actually willing to ask for something. You got to know that she had his attention. Okay? And she says, I would like to have a banquet with you tonight. I would like to invite you and Haman to a banquet tonight. Just the three of us would like to just meet in a private chamber and we can just have a meal. And I'll tell you then. So they do. The king and Haman come, and she's there. And I don't know what her plan was. I think she was just trying to think of what God would have her do. I'm not saying that God downloaded to her the whole explanation. God sometimes just gives us that next step, and that's all we get. So you take that step, and then you wait and see for further instructions. She got there, but she lost her nerve. I don't know if she was planning on telling him then or what, but somehow God impressed upon her that she should wait. And so the king says, well, my dear, what would you like? I'll give you half my kingdom. What do you want? You know, please ask for something. And she said, how about we have one more dinner tomorrow night? And then I'll tell you that. And, he says, okay, great. That's awesome. You know, this is awesome. And so Haman goes home, and I will hurry it up along. And Haman is on top of the world. He just got to have a private meeting with the king and the queen. He is just on top of the world until he sees Mordecai. Again, God put Mordecai in his path. He saw Mordecai as he walked by, and suddenly he is filled with anger. He is like, I can't believe it. I could have the whole world. Because that man is still breathing, I can't. I hate him so much. You know? But that's what God does. I mean, God takes the wicked and makes them insane. He makes them mad before he destroys them. And so Haman is sitting here going, and his wife says, well, I'll tell you what, you know, I mean, why don't you just go ask the king if you can kill Mordecai? It's not that big a deal. He's already told you he could kill all the Jews in the world. Why would he make you wait then? He said, that's a great idea. So he tells his workers to build a gallows that night, 75 feet high, and apparently it was high enough to be seen all over the entire city. 75 feet high, I think it was 50 cubits is what it says. And Haman goes to sleep. And he gets up early in the morning, and the first thing he's going to do is, as soon as the king's awake, he's going to ask him if he can go kill Haman, go kill Mordecai. And by, you know, 7:30, Mordecai's going to be hanging from his gallows. I mean, man, he's on top of things. Except, and this is the best part of this whole story, the king couldn't sleep. He had this big meal, lots of wine. We know he likes wine. No, he didn't handle it very well either. But instead of falling asleep, being drowsy, instead of calling for any of his upteen million wives, instead of calling for minstrels to come and play music for him, he says, I'll tell you what I'll do. Why don't you read me the accounts of my kingdom? That, if anything will put me to sleep, that will. Okay, you know? So he calls for the scrolls and they start reading. And you got to imagine, these guys wrote down everything. Okay, this is like bureaucracy. This is like a Chinese bureaucracy. And yet, somehow or another, towards the end of the night, the king hears about the time that Mordecai saved his life. It was buried in there somewhere. But by the providence of God, he brings it to the king's attention. So the king is sitting there, and it's, you know, it's early morning, and he says, okay, well, that's good. That's the kind of behavior that we want to encourage among our people. You know, saving the king's life is a good thing. you know, I want people to do that. I want them to get on board. So, what do we do for Mordecai? And they said, nothing. Said, really? Nothing. Well, we got to do something. So right at that moment, you can read in the story, and you know how this is, and this is the best part of the whole story. It's so funny. God has such a sense of humor. He is so good. You just got to remember that. When you got enemies and stuff, God will take care of them. Anyway, here's Haman outside the door. Here's the king, maybe sitting in his bed, saying, who's outside? Says Haman. Says, great, I need to talk to him. Get him in here. And so Haman comes running in, and the king, and the Haman says, I got something to say. And the king says, well, I got something to say too. And if you're king, you get to go first. So, the king says, okay, what would you do if you had somebody in your kingdom that you wanted to honor? And of course, Haman is so full of himself that he says, well, who could possibly be, he could be talking about anybody but me. So he says, well, so he painted his day. He says, well, I'd put him on a horse. I'd give him your crown. I'd give him your robe. I'd have your best nobleman take him through the city pronouncing, this is a man in whom the king is happy. This is a man honored by, you know, who is honored by the king. This is the kind of guy that should be full of honor and so on. And the king says, great, go do it for Mordecai. Yeah, yeah. And you can imagine what Haman was thinking at that moment. So he had no choice. He had to go do it. Come on, Mordecai, let's get you on that horse. Here's your robe. Here's your crown. Here's the man that the king likes to honor, you know. But they went through the whole city. He got to spend the entire day honoring his enemy. The man whom he was going to have killed, God honored. That's providence. That's what God does. He does this kind of stuff all the time. We just don't always see it because our eyes aren't open. But this is going on all around. I guarantee you this kind of stuff goes on in your life. I guarantee you God, maybe not to this extent, but God does stuff and you know it. We ought to be thankful for it. He protects us and cares for us. And he is so much better at solving problems than we are. Anyway, at the end of the day, Haman is like, oh, I'm glad that's over. He covers his face and I just want to go to bed. But then the guys show up to take him to their dinner date. What a difference a day makes. Okay? So now we're having another dinner. I imagine it's a little tense this time because here's the king and the queen. And Haman, and I will hurry because I know we're out of time. But here is when, finally, Esther reveals her desire. And she says to the king, she says, my request is that you will save my life and the life of my people. Because we have been set forth for death. We've been marked for death. She says, if we had just been sold into slavery to pay your accounts, I wouldn't have even said anything. But we are to be absolutely exterminated. Now you can imagine what the king said about that. He says, who is the wicked, evil person who would dare to threaten my wife, my faithful, lovey, beloved wife? And she says, it is this wicked Haman. And now the king is like really angry, and I think God is opening his eyes a little bit to understand what's going on. We see that the king leaves to go out onto a patio to think about this. At that point, Haman, the weasel that he is, falls at the foot of the bed or the couch that she's reclining on, begging for her life. And the king comes back and sees that and presumes the worst. Would you force yourself on my wife right here in front of me? And they grab him and they cover his face. And one of the guards says, you know, he made a gallows to hang Mordecai. Remember the guy who saved your life? He says, go hang him on that. And so that night, Haman was hanged on those gallows. Isn't that great? And Mordecai was promoted to the position that Haman had. This is what God does. The rest of the story is pretty simple. We've still got this problem. This happened in the third month. So in a couple of months, it's already over. We still got this problem, though, of the, you know,
the day on the 12th month. We can't rescind it. And so what they simply do is the king allows Mordecai, says, well, do what you think is right. And so they make another decree. And the second decree says that on the 12th month, on the 13th day, the Jews are allowed to defend themselves. And they can kill anyone who is plotting against them. And Mordecai, who had already been honored, now goes throughout all the countryside. And there is great favor among the Persian Empire for the Jewish people. It says a lot of people actually converted and became Jews. The fear of God came upon all of them. And obviously, Xerxes prospered under the hands of Mordecai. And when that day came, finally, it was a rout. All of the people were on the side of the Jews. And there were 75,000 people who were enemies, wicked men who were killed. Okay? And not a single Jew was hurt at all. Isn't that great? It sounds kind of harsh, doesn't it? But these people were going to exterminate the Jewish people. But God stepped in and saved the day. And that's where we get Purim, on the 12th month of the 13th day of Adar. If you'll go check your calendar, it's sometime in the spring. It's usually February, you know, when they celebrate Purim. And they recognize it. This is the Jewish holiday. It's a day of thanksgiving. It's a day of sending gifts one to another. It's a time of rejoicing, thanking God for His providence. And that's my message to you today. I know I've gone long, but I just want to say this and I'll be done. That God is the same as He ever was. There wasn't a single miracle in the classic sense in that whole book. In fact, there's not even a mention of God. But He's throughout that whole story. Because this is our experience, that God will save us and watch for us if we'll just trust Him and pray for His providence. I thank you for your kind attention. I hope that you have a very happy and blessed Thanksgiving season and that you're thankful to God for the providence He's brought in your lives. May God bless you.